Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A former justice minister in Tonga says in attempting to amend the constitution, the government is trying to grab absolute power. Akasi Povova's government is proposing an amendment that would see top roles such as the Attorney General, Police Commissioner and Anti-Corruption Commissioner appointed by the Prime Minister and Cabinet. Currently, such appointments are made by the Privy Council and the King. The former Justice Minister, Clive Edwards, says he's not entirely against the idea, but recent controversies surrounding the government, such as the attacks on the public broadcaster and corruption scandals, suggest a worrying motive. Mr. Edwards told Jamie Tahanaha that the current appointment methods act as an important balance against the power of the Prime Minister.
It is rather concerning because of what has been happening with the present government in the short time that they've been in office. Now he wants more power of getting the commissioner come under his control and appointment, as well as the Attorney General. The Attorney General was proposed before to be appointed by government. He was the leading spokesman against it, and he opposed it strongly because he believed that it should be a counterbalance to any action against government, and the Attorney General should be independent and not controlled by government.
This is Akalisi Pohiva in the last parliament, wasn't it, opposing proposals?
That's right, but now he's gone back on that, what he said then, and now he wants the Attorney General to be appointed by the PM and cabinet. So he's turned on that. And with the result to date of their actions and the way that they're behaving, it's rather concerning to us outside. And this sort of attitude that's surfacing now, it doesn't look too good at all. And for that reason, we are not in favor of having these posts or officers under the control of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. We want the police in Tonga to be independent. We want them not to be politically controlled, and we want fairness.
So this is about maintaining separation of powers in Tonga while creating a check and balance that the royal family, through the approvals they're making, creates.
The check and balance are being attacked at the moment to remove them. So there's nothing going to stop them from doing what they want to do. And frankly, we're not very happy with that, particularly with some of the caliber of the ministers and their involvement in certain actions that give us cause to feel that things are not right.
It sounds like you're suggesting that the current government's pursuing basically absolute power.
They're wanting more power. That's what they want. They want power, they want control, and they want absolute power. That's what it is. Not democracy that they were clamoring for, and that was given by the king to have a democracy in Tonga. Having given that right, the democracy to Tonga, they want any power that's left, and all under the control of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, which is a form of dictatorship, because they were trying to take the power away from the King and Privy Council that was running the country before. And they want to take all that power and start all over again, the same thing, but starting at the cabinet level. And that's not very good.
One thing, though, is this government's accountable to the electorate. I mean, can hardly claim they're going for a dictatorship when they could be thrown out at the next election, which is coming up.
I think people are very uncertain about it. We'll be able to see how they react in the next election next year, whether they condone this sort of thing that's going on or they will be against it.
Roles such as Attorney General, Police Commissioner and such, it's not overly uncommon for them to be appointed politically in other countries around the world. What is unique about the Tongan situation that this is unallowable in your view?
Well, you're quite right. A commissioner of police is normally appointed by the government. But in an early stage of democracy, for check and balance, I think the police and independence of the police at this stage is very important. Now, even the fact that cabinet was giving orders to the commissioner of police and the police to prosecute and take certain cases without evidence, and the commissioner and the police in Tonga refused to do anything about what they've been told by Canada, you can see that there is some advantage of protection there at the present time. In due course, when we have a mature democracy, I'm sure that it can go back to a normal way of doing things. But at this stage, I think it's necessary to have some check and balance in place.
Four Nepalese men are stuck on a rickety boat in the Federated State of Melanesia, nearly a year after they were given refugee status. A local lawyer says they're being detained illegally and in inhumane conditions. Sally Round reports.
The men were moved to the island state of Pohnpei at the end of June last year, after arriving with a boatload of others from Nepal and India on neighbouring Yap. They were detained on Yap for 18 months and were the only ones among the 34 men determined to be refugees. An American living on Pohnpei, Mark Dvorak, has been visiting the men, and he says they're now confined to Pohnpei's dock on a boat that needs constant pumping to stay afloat. He's concerned for their welfare.
You know, you see what looks like sadness and loneliness in their expressions. You could see that this is their third New Year's that they spent in captivity, that they're not seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mr. Dvorak says the police raided the boat and confiscated electronics the men had been given to keep them occupied and in touch. He says the International Organization for Migration has been giving them food and other care, but he says they should be allowed to leave the port while they wait for a third country to accept them.
You know, go to the island, go to the library, go to the campus. We could take them to the university, and they could, or just hiking in this beautiful land too.
A lawyer, Marstella Jack, who's a former Attorney General for the Federated States of Micronesia, says she's met with the men and will likely start taking legal action.
It's arbitrary detention. Number one, they have not been charged with anything. FSM is not a party to the Refugee Convention, but we are a member of the United Nations and we subscribe to the principles under the UN Declaration of Human Rights.
Ms. Jack says it's inhumane to keep people in such conditions for so long. She says the boat's rat-infested, the men are sleeping on the boat's hard boards with just a stove and a few pots and pans to cook food. She says she's unsure why the refugees had been waiting so long to be found a new home.
Nevertheless, you should not subject people to those kind of conditions. They're being treated, they're worse than the prisoners. Our jails here are pretty fair. Much better than the vessel that these guys are stuck on.
Ms. Jack says she'll meet with the authorities this week about the men. The FSM government has not responded yet for our request for a comment. This is Sally Round.
A Fiji civil society group is angry it was stopped from presenting its full submission on controversial legislation, it says, is punitive and should be rewritten. The Fiji government is promoting Clause 24 of the Parliamentary Powers and Privileges Bill with the aim of punishing those who demean, defame, and undermine the sanctuary of the parliament. The chairman of the Pacific Dialogue, Jonah Dakuvala, told Don Wiseman what his group thinks is wrong with the legislation, and he began describing how he was shut down at parliament.
We did present substantial submission, but halfway through, one of the members objected and wanted us to stop presenting our submission. But that submission, it pointed out that they had no power under the Parliamentary Privileges Act to have expelled three members of parliament. Three members of parliament in the opposition were expelled last year. And also pointed out that the bill is trying to legalize illegal actions that have been taken by the Privileges Committee and the government using its majority to expel these entities. And that's what upset them.
It was when you hit that particular part of your submission on the illegal expulsion of the three MPs that they decided to wrap up your presenting of the submission.
Yeah, one of the members objected to continuing. But the other thing that disappointed us was that the media were there, the journalists from all the media were there. They hardly covered our submission. There's only the Fiji Times, there was a very little piece there. And we had sent our submission and a summary of it to all the media. There was no publicity because they are fearful
of this government.
It's a very substantial submission that you'd put in. You detail, to some extent, just how there are no other jurisdictions where they're going down this road, where they're being so punitive.
Yes, we had looked at the Australian and New Zealand legislation, and we had recommended to the committee to study the New Zealand and Australian laws and come back to Parliament with a better legislation than what they're trying to push through to criminalise so-called defamation of Parliament. You know, there's no such law in New Zealand and Australia. In fact, the Privileges Act in New Zealand and Australia, they've abolished this potential power of Parliament. And it so states in the law there. And we have recommended not to use their majority in Parliament to pass through this, but to go back and study other better laws and come back.
Do they need law at all in this regard?
I do think they need to update and modernize the old Parliamentary Act. That one derived from the colonial period. And there are still provisions there that need to change because, you know, we've gone through various schools and the institutions that are defined there no longer exist. So they need to change those things and they need to update it, that legislation. So there's a case for updating it and looking at better similar laws overseas to use here.
All right. Look, I'd just like to go back to your comments about the media and the media ignoring what, as I say, is a substantial submission. Why do you think they do that?
Well, they are still fearful of the government, fearful of the Attorney General in particular, because the Attorney General has taken some of the media here to court. There are some cases still going in through court, like the Fiji Times, where they are charging some of their journalists with sedition. In a number of their decrees, they have inserted various punitive provisions that can lead to jailing of journalists who report certain issues or make comments on certain issues. So the media is very frightened.
You can understand the reticence of the journalists and the media.
Yes. They are fearful. And our submission is basically about, you know, to change the law and to remove this bill because it will be a further intimidation and restriction on the freedom of the media here. We don't need that. I pointed out to them that we already have a defamation act which protects the rights of everybody not to be defamed. And I said to the committee, look at the defamation act in New Zealand and Australia, borrow from their modern provisions. And let's have a new defamation law. And you don't need to have this criminal defamation that will enable the parliament here to act like a court, call up people, summon people, and sentence them to jail up to 5 to 10 years or $100,000 fine and all that.
With regard to the three MPs that have been suspended, and you say they have in fact been expelled illegally, you want them brought back in immediately?
We have recommended that the Privileges Committee should resume and Parliament should resume and revoke these illegal exclusions they made, that special resolutions. There was also an inter-parliamentary union. There's an international organization which met last year. And I think many of the democratic countries are members of it. They had recommended to the government to revoke these decisions that they made, which is because they are illegal. It's in a report, which is with the Speaker and Attorney General.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Delegates to the Pacific Search and Rescue Conference underway in Auckland, New Zealand, hope to find more effective ways of raising safety awareness among people using the world's biggest ocean. As Sela Jane Aholehe found out, New Zealand deals with around 100 search and rescue, or SAR, incidents each year in the Pacific.
The UN's Chief of Police Toniata Edwards says that it's important that everyone is made clear what search and rescue is.
There's different types of search and rescue when we talk about our land or when we talk about maritime, which is out at sea. I think the key of this is knowing that when you're on land, it's much simpler to sort of deal with search and rescue. But when we start talking about maritime, we're actually going out at sea, and it's probably out of our comfort zone when we do go out on the water to do search and rescue.
Mr. Edwards says that fishermen in Niue frequently go out to sea unprepared for events such as an engine breakdown.
We've brought in technical people to educate our fishermen on what they can do with outboard motors if they have a failure out at sea. So I think that's quite important for our people, because I think they get a benefit of learning more of what they can do out there rather than our little search and rescue party to go out there and look for them.
The conference is a learning ground for first-time attendees like Guam's police delegate Haralee Matsumoto. She says hearing the cost analysis of other countries has been helpful.
With that awareness, the cost of the search and rescue operations have declined since. We just do the general awareness and be like, this is X amount of money that we're using trying to find somebody due to negligence, whereas we can easily prevent X amount of funding to buy more assets instead of just going out there and wasting resources and time and energy because of negligence.
The conference is also a chance to collaborate. Tonga's Acting Deputy Police Commissioner Kepuele Taumoepeau says he is pleased to see Pacific countries adapting plans they've learned about during previous SAR conferences.
Tonga was a pilot national plan for search and rescue in the past year and a half. And then we have seen here that Solomon Islands are doing that as well. I think Samoa is going along that way. But we learn from each other.
Mr. Taumoepeau says that help from New Zealand and Australia is much appreciated in Tonga, but Tonga is still lacking human resources of their own.
We are very fortunate to have support of the New Zealand police and Australian Federal Police donating us three Stubbygrave vessels in the past a year and a half. And then from there on, I think the capacity for the people who are doing actually on this, the fields, that's what we really need to have some capacity in policing in back on Tonga.
Cook Islands Ministry of Transport Delegate Junior Ngato Koroa says it's vital his country is well prepared because of the high number of tourists they cater for.
Basically, this is on a sustainable management plan. We have to make sure that we are a safe place, to make sure we send the message out to the tourist industry. They are safe to come to the Cook Islands. That's why we have to be on top of everything.
The highlight of the SAR conference will be a public demonstration on Auckland's Waitemata Harbour on Wednesday afternoon. This is Sela Jane Aholele.
The University of the South Pacific today will open its new campus in Marshall Island. The $2 million campus is situated in the renovated section of the Long Island Hotel, which had previously been acquired by the Marshall Islands government. The government contributed $500 million U.S. to the renovations, while the USP provided the balance. The USP's Vice Chancellor, Rashid Chandra, who is in Marshall Islands this week for the opening, spoke to Corey Hawkins about the Long Island campus.
It is a very important component of our regional campus strategy because this is the main campus in Northern Pacific. The previous campus was a temporary campus with always the view that a new modern campus would be built. So we had difficulty in having enough classrooms. We had to split our operations at two places. And essentially the learning environment in terms of computer lab, science lab, quality of staff officers, that was not the kind that we want fitted into the university's branding of being an excellent university.
And how many students will that service?
Well, it has the capacity to serve over 1,000 students. At the moment, we have around 500 students. So it will allow for all of the current ones and a good amount of future expansion for the students. And we have still a lot of capacity because we have renovated only one building or three buildings.
Within the same complex?
Yes. So the hotel had, you know, three large buildings, and we have taken the one that meets the academic requirement. And the other two buildings, one is being used as a convention hall, and the other building is used for some accommodation.
Right. So you have a potential for even further expansion if need be.
Yes, significant. In fact, this is, it was a fully functioning Long Island hotel with the beach and you know, right on the water. So probably the most beautiful campus of all our campuses.
Now you mentioned on your way to Marshalls, you stopped off in Kiribati to look at campuses there. Where else in the region are you? Is your push to establish further campuses going on?
So we currently have 12 members, and we already operate 14 campuses. Of these places, we have a desperate need for a new campus, Solomon Island, and so there. We have taken a soft loan from the Asian Development Bank, and we have given out the engineering design and building supervision contract to the engineers there. And that's the biggest project that is underway at the moment in terms of campuses. And in Nauru, a new campus is being developed as part of the Australian funded land village. That will be ready sometime in October.
It is coming up to a year since Australia unilaterally removed the island's autonomy and placed it with the regional council under the control of New South Wales. The move angered many, prompting months of protests and appeals for international help. If there have been significant changes made into the lives of Norfolk Islanders, Don Wiseman asked the mayor and head of the regional council, Robin Adams, how people feel about Canberra's moves.
That would depend entirely on who you're speaking with, but I think generally it would be reasonable for me to say that Norfolk Island is endeavouring to move into a brand new world. A brand new world where we are coming for the first time into the Australian taxation and social welfare system, having, of course, had our own system since 1979, so there are big changes happening there. What is currently on the table, which is causing considerable concern in the community, is that we are being required to move to valuation-based land rating system commencing 1 July 2018. And this week we have had two public meetings where the community have been addressed by the Valuer General for Norfolk Island's land, and it was absolutely evident to all of us present the absolute concern in this community, because what has to be understood here is that when the Pitcairn community was moved to Norfolk Island in 1856, and all of the Pitcairn families were given 50-acre land grants, that land was regarded and continues to be regarded as heritage land, like throughout the Pacific. You know, there's perhaps a bigger attachment to land than what there might be in, say, Australia as a whole. And to find that we now have to pay land rates and have our land valued for the purposes of rating is causing a lot of uncertainty in the communities.
Communities all across Australia and New Zealand are going to say, well, the rates are about paying for government services, paying for roads,
that's
and whatever,
correct.
And
yes,
that's valid, surely.
Yeah, but please understand that, you know, since 1856 up until the present day, Norfolk Island has managed without that system being in place. But with the changes that have now been brought upon us, with the removal of the Norfolk Island government and now having a regional council, we have to work under a totally different legal regime. So yes, it's a learning curve for the community, and you know, with any change, there is always uncertainty. And there's a very real concern in the community that if they're unable to pay their rates, the land that they have held on to since 1856 could very well be lost. But yes, it's understood. Council has to make money in order to provide the services to the community. And yeah, it's an interesting time, Don.
What sort of rates are people going to be looking at, do you think?
Oh, I couldn't answer that question because this is the very first time we now have a Valuer General, and I've just come out of a meeting with him and other councillors where he was explaining the methodology of how he would go about rating the land. But of course he too has a difficulty that there's nothing to work from. There's no platform of previous rating and categorisation, etc. So it's a totally brand new world for Norfolk Island here. And we will get there. But it's just all part of a huge change from having self-government removed from the community to one where laws, for example, the Commonwealth has applied New South Wales legislation to Norfolk Island. And the continuing concern there is, which I share and am working with the Commonwealth to try and resolve, is that by applying New South Wales law Tunal for Garland. We have no representation in New South Wales. We are not part of New South Wales. But yet we have a parliament making laws that are going to affect Norfolk Island, of which we have no say in. And that's seen as a democratic deficit.
When you say you're working with the Commonwealth,
I'm
what
in conversation with the Federal Minister, Senator Nash, who appreciates the concern. And we have in place still a large proportion of Norfolk Island legislation still in place. And I'm proposing, with Council's support, that we find a way to modernise existing Norfolk Island law to mirror New South Wales law, rather than applying New South Wales law to us, over which we've had no say, and trying to put a bit more democracy on the table here around the law that's going to affect us at state and local level.
And what sort of indication are you getting that you might make some progress there?
Look, willingness on the part of the Minister to communicate, and she has tasked the administrator, our new administrator, Mr. Eric Hutchinson, and I to work together and to consult with the community around this issue, and positive that we'll have a good conversation. I can't forecast what the outcome is finally going to be, but, you know, there's a willingness there to have a conversation, and I can't ask for more than that.
Okay, but apart from this issue over the rates, is the air of animosity that existed, has that lifted?
I'll try and respond to that by saying there is still very much a want for Norfolk Island to have a say in its governance model going forward. And you would be aware, Don, that there is a movement that Norfolk Island be listed with the United Nations under their arena. And that continues to be progressed at international level. In the meantime, the community is trying its hardest to get on with the framework of governance which we've got now, but still retaining the want to have proper process put back in place that they can have a proper decision taken around how we go forward into the future. And that is an ongoing concern.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.